body.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm Daniel.
And boy, do we have an episode for you today. We are diving back into the Warren files.
Hey-o.
And we had to dive deep. Very deep.
Very deep.
Because if you've been a listener of the show, you know we've covered pretty much every story or case done by Ed and Lorraine Warren, pretty much known to man. So we had to dive into books this time around.
Yeah, I'm looking up, what was the, sorry, I should have had this on hand, what book this was.
Because we're like, you know, these guys claim to have investigated 10,000 cases over the course of their career, but it seems like we only have maybe like 12 or so that we've done at this point.
Yeah. Okay, it's the book Ghost Hunters.
So, yeah, we took a look at that book and we came up with a very interesting and crazy story.
Crazy.
Talking Ouija board demonic possession on a whole other level. I mean, there's just so much crazy shit that happens with this particular case. The story is known as The Exorcism of Stacy Collins. And I think one of the interesting things about this particular story is, as many of you know with the Warrens, it's very hard to cross-reference or research their cases because there's just very little information out there publicly.
Unfortunately, I could not verify that anybody really exists in this story, including the priest I tried to look for as well. So it's just going to be a trust me, bro, kind of story here.
Which they do quite a bit. They do. Trust me, bro. I mean, there's obviously some of the larger cases, Amityville, Enfield, you know, some of those definitely had some more, you know, people in the public associated with it. But this story, all we know is that it was the Collins family who experienced this haunting. And that's about it. We don't even know first names.
That's it. We don't even know the city that they were in.
Amazing.
Just somewhere in New Hampshire.
But yeah, with that being said, this may be the end of the Warren files here on Lights Out. And I know some of you be very disappointed and maybe even a little sad by that because, you know, their stories and cases are, I mean, truly fascinating and disturbing and scary all at the same time. But yeah, we've kind of come to the end of the road, I think.
And especially where we're going to end this episode with a little bit of something as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, finally uncovered some things that came out around the Warrens that you may or may not have heard of. And we hadn't heard of it. And we've been covering the Warrens for years. Yeah. And it was honestly surprising to, I think some people may have alluded to some of the things we'll talk about here at the end in the comments over the years, but I swear that nobody like sent us the articles or anything like that. So this was all kind of news to us. And I think it definitely changes the perspective. I know that we have, and I know many people out there have around the Warrens and their legacy. And it's kind of leaves a nasty taste in the mouth.
Sour note.
Yeah. But before we get into all that, we do want to talk about the Collins family haunting and the exorcism that followed. So we got to go all the way back. We're going to rewind here to the 1970s is when this story begins. And it begins with 17-year-old Stacy Collins, who is your typical teenager from downstate New Hampshire. For a time, she was just a regular run-of-the-mill 17-year-old, like any other, obsessed with dating, shopping, and going out with friends. And for three nights a week, plus weekends, she would often head into town and meet up with friends, window shop, and eventually end up at a small local diner called the Hot Dog Hutch, baby, with her girlfriends. Who doesn't love a glizzy, man?
Yum.
I can always smash a glizzy. So they'd make their weekend plans, and by Saturday, they'd catch a movie at the fourplex across the mall's parking lot, and the rest of her friends would catch a date to the movies, especially while they ate at the Hot Dog Hutch. But not Stacy. She never seemed to get a date, which is, you know, I feel for her. It's never
hard.
Fun. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard being 17 years old, man. It was rough times.
Agreed.
So she was always the odd man out at the movies. Over time, this wore down her confidence. Her self-esteem plummeted, and she thought something must be wrong with her. When she brought up her concerns to her friends, one of them told her that she just tried too hard, and if she would just relax a little, she wouldn't scare the boys away. You can take that for what that is. Yeah. I don't really know what to make of that.
That's a very straightforward friend, though. I mean, sometimes that's the advice you need. It's just like, Stacy, you just need to chill
the fuck out, yeah, man. Scaring people. Stacy even admitted she had a tendency to be a little bit obsessive when it came to dating. On another rainy spring Saturday afternoon, she met up at the mall with friends, as she always did. But everyone had to cancel this time. Two friends had caught the flu, and another visited her brother at college. So Stacy found herself alone. So she went over to the Hutch, ordered a grilled cheese, and then wandered around the mall for a while. After an hour or two, she ended up at the northern end of the mall, where the smaller mom and pop style shops had always been. And there was this custom doll shop there, a boutique, and a place to make your own karaoke music video. That sounds fun. Sadly, none of these new storefronts would last very long, and new shops were constantly shuffling in and out at the northern end. But that's when Stacy spotted a brand new shop there called the Antique Attic. And figuring she had nowhere else to be, she headed inside for a while. And this small store housed a variety of objects, toys and household items with odd descriptions like neoclassic, diamond faceted, and Dalton stoneware. She then wandered toward the back where a dusty antique jack-in-the-box rested. Right as she was about to leave, on the shelf above the jack-in-the-box, she spotted an item that she had been interested in for a long time. But she never dared to use one. You could probably guess what this object was. Lo and behold, it was a Ouija board. So, you know, totally understand. We're all intrigued by the Ouija board, you know. Austin carries his around daily. Is it still in
my car? Yeah, it's in my trunk.
Have you checked on it?
I'm waiting. Yeah. Last time I saw, there was a bunch of blood all over it.
There's just a hole burnt into it. So, yeah, you know, Austin's good friends with his Ouija board. They're connected at the hip.
We talk.
Literally.
Yeah.
This Ouija board looked like any other one, except its chipped and scratched wood made it look like it had been just picked from a dumpster. Despite the rough condition, Stacy thought that it looked cool. You know, kind of a vintage board, it sounds like. And as Stacy pulled it from the shelf, the owner mentioned that she had found it after buying a lot of antique items and that its true origin was unknown. So Stacy offered her $5 for it, and the shopkeeper agreed, thankful to just get rid of it. For the next 3 months, Stacy got familiar with this Ouija board as much as she could. She read about how to properly use one, and she got up the courage to start experimenting with it alone, which,
yeah, red flag,
you know, caution alert. According to some, this would break one of the rules for using a Ouija board. You never use the board alone, Austin.
I have done this.
Others also suggest never using one in your home.
And I've also done this.
And we'll soon find out why this is the case. Either way, Stacy figured it didn't matter if they broke the rules, because nothing had ever happened. And she was beginning to think that the board was a dud. Every time she tried to reach out to the spirits, there's just dead silence. As days passed, she figured the board didn't have any supernatural powers, and, you know, she had just wasted $5 at the antique shop and, you know, probably getting pretty skeptical about it at this point. But she continued to play it as a game just for fun and to terrify her friends, which I don't know if this is really helping her friends' advice of chill out.
Yeah. She's like, Ouija board. We're talking to spirits now.
That'll definitely bring in the guys.
And it's funny because I did think, do you remember, I can't remember the name of the family, but it was the daughter who was kind of lonely and she found a spirit boyfriend through the Ouija board.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering if Stacy was, maybe she's like a little lonely. She's like, hey, maybe a cute spirit boy might talk to me through this thing.
Maybe. I mean, that's pretty desperate at this point, you know? But hey, you know, who am I to judge? So one weekend, Stacy invited her good friend Jenny Brooks over to her house. Jenny had expressed some interest in the occult and messing around with the Ouija board. Through a friend, she heard that they really worked, because everybody's got a friend who's like, dude, the Ouija board really works, you know? And we're like, yeah, okay, sure. Stacy brought Jenny up to her bedroom on the second floor, and she pulled out the old board, and they sat across from each other, cross-legged on Stacy's bed. They then reached their hands to the planchette and their session began. They agreed Stacy would be the leader in their seance, so she asked questions, called out to nearby spirits, and truly opened herself up to the supernatural. But still, nothing. Just crickets. After a while, Stacy got pretty impatient, so she wanted the session to end. But right as she was about to shift the planchette to goodbye, Jenny said she felt a presence in the room, and a look of fear crossed her face. But Stacy saw nothing and felt nothing around her. She thought that her friend was just messing with her, and she told Jenny, "Oh no, it's just a game, what are you talking about?" But Jenny told her to shut the hell up and said that she could hear something. So shit's getting real. Both of them quieted down, and sure enough, coming in through the silence, they could hear a low, rasping voice sound every few seconds. As it grew louder, it seemed to be coming from the bedroom wall beneath her Michael Jackson poster.
Was it like,
Michael, is that you? That's kind of weird, though.
It is. That is scary. I think the Michael Jackson poster is kind of scary, too.
Totally. I mean, and add the voice to that, it'd be tearing that shit down right away. Yeah. As Stacy moved toward the wall, the noise seemed to emanate from within it, like a scratching noise, like a sickly hand with gnarled nails trying to escape the small space inside of that wall. Jenny jumped up from the bed and said she couldn't keep going. But out of fear, Stacy grabbed her by the arm, and then she played the ultimate guilt trip card, saying, quote, "If you're really my friend, you'll stay here with me and see what happens."
Mm-mm.
Jenny looked at her in the eyes, and the scratching intensified, and it now sounded more like a large claw literally tearing through the drywall. Jenny decided she wouldn't stick around to find out. I mean, she was pretty spooked at this point, and no guilt trip by a friend was worth summoning a demon or exposing herself to demonic energy any more than she already had. So she raced to the bedroom door and told Stacy that she needed to get rid of that board immediately before it got worse. She also suggested that she tell her mother, Mrs. Collins, about it. She then slammed the bedroom door on her way out, and Stacy heard her friend's footsteps racing through the hallway down the stairs, and then the front door slamming as she ran home. All the while, the clawing sound in the wall kept growing louder. She's like, hell yeah. She's like, this is the best case scenario.
Also, man, the guilt trip, the if you're really my friend, you blah, blah, blah. I hate that. I hate it.
Nobody likes friends like that.
No.
Because it's pressure.
If you're going to guilt trip me like this, then maybe we weren't really friends to begin with.
Don't you care about me?
Yeah.
If I'm scared, you should say, it's okay.
Yeah.
You can leave.
Yeah. And we'll close the session.
No, get in here.
Yes, Tristan.
You're doing this with me. Oh, man.
But wow. So this story continues. About another month passed after the incident. Stacy's group of friends didn't see much of her like they used to. But one day, Stacy decided to finally come out of her house.
She's just been in that room. She's just
been locked in there with this demon. So they all met up at the mall and headed to the hutch.
Get that glizzy, baby.
Oh, yeah. It'll heal anything, right?
Dude, I had a Costco dog the last weekend.
Last week I had a Costco dog, actually. It hits. It hits.
So good.
Those nitrates will cast out any demons from without.
The better part is it's $1.50. You know, there's something... Like, you get a dopamine rush when you buy a Costco dog.
It feels like it's 1994.
You feel like you got it for free, basically. Yeah, you're like, damn, I get a soda, too.
Yeah. I know they lose money on those, too. So, get people in the door like me.
Fuels you up to go spend $800 on random shit at Costco.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great nutrition as well, as we all know.
It's very good for you.
Yeah. Mm. I do it before I go to the gym. Just slam one of those things.
Yeah, man. You could put down a couple of those, too.
Yeah, I could.
So dangerous.
Anyways.
Back to the hutch.
So Stacy comes in, and they all order. Stacy only orders a water, which is odd. She had also, they noticed she lost some weight and made her look really gaunt and frail. Her eyes had also lost their color. They were once bright and blue, now dull and tired.
Damn, it's like the lice being sucked out of
her. Yeah, so Stacy's gone through it. And I mean, a month is, that's quite a long time to be messing with the Ouija board and isolated as well. So her parents also noticed the drastic change in Stacy back home. And eventually, school counselors caught on to something being wrong as well. But no one could figure out what had drained Stacy so much in the past month. It was like she was an entirely different person. Her energy plummeted, her weight dropped, and the spark in her eyes had faded. So here is where things get interesting. You might think, oh, this is kind of just a standard case here, but it's about to really ramp up.
Is it just a teen going through a teen phase?
Right, it could be.
You know, being a little rebellious.
Right. 17-year-old, a little depressy might be in there.
Or is this the early onset of demonic possession?
Or exactly.
It's one or two or yeah. The other. There's no in between.
So, Mrs. Collins, Stacy's mother, said, this is verbatim what she said, quote, "It was about this time that I heard the noises up in her room. Her father, who is a doctor and who likes logical explanations for everything, said that Stacy was merely singing along with her tapes, but I didn't think so." So cassette tapes for anybody who's who might be too young to know what the hell that is. They used to put music on tape. So to continue, quote, "There was a disturbing quality to it," meaning the sound, "almost like moaning. And then one day, I realized what it was, and I had a most difficult time dealing with it. What I seemed to be hearing were the sounds of people making love. At first, I just refused to believe it. We'd raise Stacy in a very proper way, and even if she did occasionally spend some time with a boy, I just knew that she was still a virgin. I didn't want to rush up to her room and make a fool out of myself. For the next few days, I contented myself with my husband's explanation, that Stacy was just going up to her room and singing along with the tapes she likes to play."
What? Okay. What could this be?
What music has sexual moaning? Maybe like Zeppelin. We got his voice. A little,
Michael Jackson.
A little Michael Jackson.
Or maybe she was like, there's definitely some like hip hop out there. It's got like some bed creaking.
Sure, and yeah.
A little bit of, you know, yeah, there. Yeah. But it's, she's saying love making sounds.
Yes.
And it's loud.
Loud enough to hear it not from within the room.
So there's a couple options. She has somebody up there. They're doing the dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe she's, you know, just doing something with herself, you know.
That could be it as well.
Pleasuring yourself is another option.
Yep.
Or, which
that's how, when I was 17, I did it really loud so that my whole family could hear.
That's very disturbing.
No, but really, like, it, people are, teenagers are usually try to be discreet, right, about this.
Would
so,
be quiet. Why would it be so loud?
Yeah. You know,
knowing that your parents are downstairs and going to hear it.
Right.
Or if you're like watching, maybe she was watching pornography.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, at that age, you're being discreet about it.
Yeah.
As much as you can be.
Right. So why is the volume blaring, you know?
Very strange.
Very odd. I also don't like the fact that she's like tracking her daughter. I mean, I get it, but it's, she's like, no, she's still a virgin. And I'll defend that point.
Yeah.
So it does read a little bit like maybe this is a religious household.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. A little bit.
So one day, Mrs. Collins noticed the moaning got extremely loud. It was so loud, in fact, that the whole house could hear it, and Stacy's little brother sat at the kitchen table, just dying of laughter. Mrs. Collins had tried to respect her daughter's privacy up until now, but she decided, you know what, enough is enough.
Come on, dude.
We're trying to eat breakfast.
Okay. There wasn't ever a moment before this that she just like went to check on her daughter and be like, hey, honey, you okay? Is everything, you know?
No, it got to the point where it was the whole house was having to listen to this.
It's hard not to laugh because you just picture this in your head. There's moaning. So, and this is moaning, like lovemaking moaning.
Yeah.
That has gotten so loud, like seemingly louder than what a human can even produce.
Right.
Right. You're just now being like, okay, this is strange.
Maybe I should go check on it.
Maybe I should see that there's not somebody in there with her. Or what the hell's going on here? Because
yeah, I know. Personally, my mom would be immediately up my ass about what is going on here. Like, she wouldn't even really like, you know, my door closed when I was a teenager.
My parents just barged into my room.
Yeah, exactly.
They just were like in the middle of the night too, caught me a couple times, and that was embarrassing.
Yeah,
and I kept very low key, discreet, no sound. I still got busted. So I can only imagine if there was moaning coming from my room, what my parents would have done.
Oh, yeah.
They would have been in there immediately.
Yeah.
See if I had snuck somebody in or, mm-hmm. you know, I was enjoying a film very loudly.
Yeah. So I guess maybe
lots of questions.
Yeah. Just, I guess maybe her parents were a little tried to, like she
said,
so
maybe not religious. They're being pretty chill.
True. They're like, no, we respect her privacy. It's okay.
And I get it. Like, you know, it's your daughter. You want to, you know.
Give her some space.
Hold off on that as long as possible. I get it. I totally get it. But it's like, you never once asked, like, hey, are you experimenting?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here?
Or even just the
are
question.
Are you okay?
Yeah. Like, are you being safe about it?
Right.
It seems like they're just ignoring everything to the point where it's just ridiculously loud and they put it off for too long.
And just assuming that it's lovemaking sounds. Because what if it was something else? What if she's like, sometimes you moan when you're in pain. Like,
true, yeah.
And it could kind of sound like that. So they're not even, it's just like,
She stubbed her toe and that's all that happened.
Damn.
So Mrs. Collins, you know, she did figure maybe it was a neighborhood boy that had snuck into Stacy's room by climbing the lattice work against the house to reach her bedroom window on the second floor. Very like 80s movie-esque.
Yeah. You know,
the boy climbing in through the bedroom window. Lattice work is like the cross stuff you see sometimes
people
vine
like
grow on it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah. So that was maybe her thought. And she expected to burst into Stacy's room and just catch them in the act. Instead, as she cranked the handle and swung open the door, the moaning and wailing completely stopped. Dead silence. And she found Stacy in bed, fully clothed, with her headphones on, listening to music. No one else was in the room as far as she could tell. So was she just covering it up really well?
Or maybe Mrs. Collins is just imagining things. Maybe she's got something else on the mind. I don't know.
True.
She probably had that question when she went in and like, am I crazy?
I would.
She's got headphones on. She's clearly not doing anything. So why am I here?
What's going on?
Is something trying to send me a message?
That I need to have more sex.
Yes.
So Stacy's obviously laying there. She's startled to see her mother barging in. She took off her headphones and asked, what the hell's going on? But as she spoke, her mother could tell that something was a little bit different about her. Her anger was fierce, which was out of character for her. And Mrs. Collins understood that, you know, she had violated her daughter's privacy, so she had a reason to be upset. But her daughter's strange, lower tone of voice suggested that Stacy was no longer Stacy, her daughter. She was also incredibly thin by then, with dark circles around her eyes, and her nails had been chewed down to the skin until they bled. To me, this is like, we need to go to the hospital.
Yes.
Yeah. Something is not correct here. As Mrs. Collins scanned the room, looking for a hiding teenage boy, she noticed the old Ouija board in her daughter's room for the first time. Stacy had kept it a secret from her family for nearly 4 months. Mrs. Collins said, quote, while my husband was raised Protestant, I was raised strict Catholic, so they are religious. And even a glance at the Ouija board told me it was a sinister presence.
Because of course.
Yeah, of course.
That's the first thing you think of. See the Ouija board, you're like, all right, adds up.
Yep. Evil. So I asked Stacy why she'd have such a thing in her room, and she told me that it was none of my business. Only rarely did she talk back to me in this way.
So this sets it up of like, this was such a drastic change in their daughter that she's immediately going like, okay, it's not my daughter just being
going
a teenager.
Yeah.
It's this object in her room. It's got to be doing something.
Yeah.
It's very obvious.
So Mrs. Collins, she tried to confiscate the board from her, but when she reached for it, Stacy jolted from her bed, slapped her mother's hand away. In a low timbre, she said, "Leave it alone, it's mine."
I just got chills. That's terrifying.
Mrs. Collins tried to grab it again, and this time, Stacy grabbed onto her mother's arms with both hands. The mother said the grip felt like a strong, hulking man, and it hurt her arm. And for the first time in 17 years, Mrs. Collins was afraid of her daughter.
This is just too convenient. You know, you've got, she's clearly already assuming this is a demonic possession. This is not my daughter. Something has infested my daughter. She's not talking the way she normally does. She's got hulking strength.
I went towards the Ouija board to take it away. She got violent with me. Yeah. Pretty cut and dry here. Possession. Yeah.
Clearly.
So, Mrs. Collins, she's upset. Her daughter just attacked her. So, you know, she starts crying. She fled the room. And the last image she saw was Stacy cradling the Ouija board like a newborn child. She loves that thing.
Time to get some help.
Yeah. Time to get some help. We need to call the doctors, call the priests.
Her dad's a doctor.
Yeah, true. Yeah, like, where's he at?
Get in here, Dad. God.
So, sure enough, in comes Dr. Collins. She remained in her room until her father got home from work. And after Mrs. Collins basically filled him in on the altercation and this crazy drastic change in their daughter, he stormed his way upstairs into Stacy's bedroom. He found her in a fit of rage, still protecting the Ouija board and never letting it go.
I can't help but say this.
What?
I just am picturing Gollum with the ring right now.
Yeah,
yeah. And this is Stacy.
Do you have a good Gollum impression?
My precious. My precious.
Oh, that's even better.
What else does he
say? Clutching the Ouija board.
I only wish to catch a fish, so don't say sweet.
Amazing. 10 out of 10. Andy Serkis, everybody.
Thank you. I'll be here indefinitely. It's unclear exactly what happened when he went up there, though. Dr. Collins.
He got a stethoscope out. Started doing a physical.
Check your heartbeat. So it sounds like he's a practical man. He was raised Protestant. So he's going up there. Obviously, I don't know, putting myself in his foot, in his shoes, I would think there's something physically, medically, psychologically wrong with my daughter. Maybe this is just a weird phase, but he's going to go up there and try to figure it out. Unfortunately, it's unclear what exactly happened next, because Dr. Collins really never gave his statement on this case. We only have the Warrens and the mother, and I think maybe a little bit from the father as well. So it's unclear what happened up there, and neither Stacy nor Dr. Collins ever spoke of their interaction that day. But when he returned downstairs, he's just slowly pacing the halls. Mrs. Collins saw that his face was as pale as a ghost, and he said nothing to her. He slowly walked over to the den, sat down in complete darkness, and just stared into space for about a half hour. He had never acted like this before, but whatever happened in Stacy's bedroom that night sent him into shock and basically just shattered his self-confidence.
Jesus Christ. It's like, what happened in there?
Good God. I don't know.
Did he get like...
I like he goes up there like, I'm going to discipline my daughter. We're going to figure out what's going on. And he just comes back like...
What, she shapeshift into a demon? Like, Jesus Christ, man. Do something. This is out of my...
Yeah, he's like, no...
My realm here.
No medical intervention could help my daughter.
He's probably like a podiatrist, a foot doctor or something.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
He has no idea.
Yeah. He's a dentist.
Yeah, of course. Well, for the next 3 days, the Collins household became a living nightmare. Mrs. Collins compared it to a, quote, cheap TV movie. Very odd pretty thing to say, but kind of telling. But more terrifying because this was real, a real living nightmare. The clawing, scraping noises within Stacy's bedroom wall had become so loud that it shook every room of the house. And the pounding and moaning of intense sexual ecstasy could be heard all the way from Stacy's bedroom to the first floor dining room.
Nice.
Imagine those family dinners are awkward. Okay. If this is happening in your home, why does nobody call the fucking police to come and make sure there's nobody hiding in your home?
Right. Or just like sneaking into the daughter's bedroom window or something.
Or get a goddamn axe from the garage and hack open the wall.
There we go. Here's Johnny. Yeah.
Blast like, in figure there. Out what's going on. You know,
I imagine they're just like Stacy's up in her bedroom and they sit down for family dinner. There's just one empty chair. Stacy's not there
eating
like,
their steak.
Honey, how was your day at work?
Yeah,
it's just like,
No need to insert sound effects this week.
We got it.
Yeah, it's just, oh man, I've just never heard of anything like this before. This is just on a different level.
And maybe this family is like really good at just pretending like things aren't happening. They've just maybe up until now, they've just ignored so much that any confrontation they just don't like. I don't know.
Beats me. I have no idea what's going on here at all. Well, as time goes on, Stacy becomes more withdrawn. Her weight continued to drop, which the dramatic weight loss, that is a sign that something is wrong with your child. Like you need
hospital,
you know, and to have a dad as a doctor and he's not like, we need to go deal with this.
Yeah. Pretty odd.
Suspect.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what's going on here? Is this really happening? Or why aren't you getting help for your kid?
Right.
Because any parent would be like, this, something's psychologically wrong. Like we need to go get her evaluated ASAP because this could go bad very quickly. And just seems like they're just like, yeah, we'll just deal with it. She'll figure it out. You know, it's like, yeah. Come on. Come on now. It seems like the life is leaving their daughter and she would just be found in one of two states pretty much, either sobbing in her room or in a violent fit of rage. So finally, the Collins reached out to a psychiatrist. A Protestant minister and a Catholic priest.
The trifecta.
You would think that at least with bringing a psychiatrist in the situation, that there would be some type of help given, some type of diagnosis or recommendation to go see a specialist or somebody else to try and help improve Stacy's condition. Well, nothing helped at all, which is like, what? I can understand maybe the minister and the priest not being able to do anything, but psychiatrists?
Unless if the psychiatrist is just a complete quack.
True.
Which could maybe be, but also, I don't know. I feel like most people who get into the profession genuinely want to help people.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally. Or would have recommended, I don't know what to do here.
This is out of
Send
my hands.
You to somebody else. Somebody out there will be able to help you and give you some answers.
Right.
Well, that just didn't happen. It just seemed like the balls just dropped from there because Stacy had gotten so bad that she dropped out of school and refused to speak to any of her family members. Damn.
That's huge.
That's really big.
Something serious is going on.
And at this point, her parents were totally convinced that the Ouija board was to blame here. So one night, her father tried to break into her bedroom in order to steal the Ouija board and destroy it. When he did, the bedroom was dark, but the vague shapes of furniture and objects could be seen by the faint moonlight of her bedroom window. And he figured that Stacy was asleep in bed. But after two or three steps into the room, Stacy leapt out of the shadows and grabbed him, causing him to stumble backward into the wall behind him. And while he was on the ground, she slapped his face and then grabbed his head and slammed it into the bedroom wall. For a moment, she backed off, crawling back into the shadows. She then began hurling random objects at him in order to get him to leave. And in the short moments between being pelted with objects, Dr. Collins tried his best to scan the room for the Ouija board, but it was nowhere to be seen. Stacy, or whatever she had become, had hidden it away for safekeeping.
This is a lot like the One Ring, the more we get into this.
Literally.
Yeah.
Literally. It's like she's turned into Gollum at this point.
Yeah. She's totally possessed by it.
It's like the end of the Return of the King.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Fuck.
Yeah. That's such a great scene. Also, it's so sad that Frodo was so affected by the ring that he's like, basically, he's like, I'm going to go die in the lands away from here because...
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. It's no one, come on, guys. Get with it.
It's been 20 plus years. So, yeah. Or more than that. Like,
but I always think of that, though, because it was, you know, a long time had passed and he still felt the effects like that of addiction to the ring.
Yeah.
He was like, I have to leave and I have to go die somewhere.
Kind of a demonic possession story.
Yeah. True.
You know, if you really dig into it, but
yeah,
that's for another episode.
Yeah. You break down Lord of the Rings,
Lord
demonic
of the Rings
possession.
Paranormal breakdown. Yeah.
But the ring was a cursed object.
There you go. 100% it was. Anyways, we're someone needs to come check on us, I think. Over the next 2 weeks and three psychiatry sessions later, Stacy was eventually admitted to a psychiatric hospital in upstate New Hampshire. My God, about time. Like, come on, dude.
This took so long.
It took her physically attacking her father.
And her mother.
Yeah.
She technically already attacked
her mother.
No, both
had to be attacked.
Yeah.
Before they're like, all right, this is beyond our control here. And according to her mother, when they put her into the psychiatric hospital, they tried to give her a couple different tranquilizers, but even these barely calmed her down, which is like, what?
That's crazy.
That you don't hear about that every day. Mm-mm. Her intense fits of absolute rage continued, and so did her obsession with the Ouija board. Late one night, an attendant at the hospital entered Stacy's room to check on her. They noticed that Stacy was not asleep, but sitting upright in her bed. In front of her, they saw the same old Ouija board from the antique store. Somehow, she had snuck the board into the hospital. Although to this day, no one knows how that could be possible. So we've got some like fucking
teleportation.
Like, what's going on?
Is the demon like picking up the board and snuck in the hospital and gave it to her?
I don't even know what's going on. This is crazy. And after hearing about this incident the next day, Mrs. Collins said, you know what? Bring in the big guns. And she reached out to Ed and Lorraine Warren. She's desperate. She's like, these guys have done this a zillion times. They'll have the answers. So let's talk about the Warrens a little bit. You know, we've covered them quite a bit. You know, most of you know who they are. You know their story. But if you're not familiar, we'll give you a quick little rundown of the Warrens. So Ed Warren was a famous demonologist, self-taught, mind you. And Lorraine was a clairvoyant and medium. They were a husband and wife duo, had worked together for about 50 years in the paranormal business. They even created the New England Society for Psychic Research, or NESPR, and over their career, they claimed to have investigated over 10,000 paranormal cases, and they never charged anything for their investigations. Instead, they made money by giving lectures and licensing their stories, and really their patients or, you know,
clients
yeah. stories yeah. is really what it is. Is it really their story?
True.
That's just because they
point.
Got involved.
Mm.
I think that's debatable. And as you know, their work has inspired the Conjuring movie universe franchise, which has grossed over $1.2 billion. That is staggering.
It's a lot of money.
Ed later passed in 2006 after years of failing health, and Lorraine passed away in 2019 naturally in her sleep. And they've left behind a vast and controversial legacy, and many people have accused them of being outright frauds who have preyed on vulnerable families. But others believe their stories entirely. Either way, they were a popular team to contact for paranormal investigations in the late 1900s, especially in New England, because this is, you know, that's where they're from.
Yep, Connecticut. And yep.
A lot of cases take place in New England. Mm-hmm. So over a phone call, the Warrens quickly agreed to investigate Stacy's case, but not without some additional help. They reached out to a friend, Father Peter Martins, a Nigerian priest they first met in Nova Scotia after one of their lectures. And they could immediately tell that he was well-versed in the supernatural, and he spoke about terrifying experiences with demonic forces and exorcisms back in his home country. Lorraine described him as having a, quote, somber wisdom and a, quote, gravity peculiar to people who had done battle with the spirit realm. So, you know, he's like a UFC fighter in the paranormal world.
Yeah, he's
goes
a veteran.
Toe-to-toe with the forces of evil. So fast forward 2 years from when they had met, the Warrens heard through the grapevine that Father Martins was in New Hampshire at the same time that they received this frantic phone call from Mrs. Collins. And the Warrens could sense this phone call was different from the others that they usually received. So they teamed up with Father Martins and headed over to Collins' home. So what that tells me is that based on the phone conversation with Mrs. Collins, they knew without even investigating or meeting Stacy that this was some type of demonic infestation. And so they knew we got to get the big guns in here, which makes me wonder, is like, what did Ed do?
Right.
Like, I know he did some like basic rites and, you know, basic rituals, but anytime an exorcism is done, he's bringing in a priest, it seems like.
Yeah.
So is he just there to identify the issue?
Just to like, yeah. Is that it? Are they just facilitators?
I think that's kind of what a demonologist is. Is they're kind of just there to like figure out if this is
they,
if
like,
they're
dealing with a demon. It.
Yeah, because if you look into demonology, it's really like understanding the traits, qualities, understanding the different types, and maybe like how best to deal with them.
Gotcha.
He's like pest control.
yeah. But he doesn't rid the pest. But he has to get the priest.
No,
in.
he. Then refers
he just
you.
Identifies the pest. Yeah. Like, there it is.
We There's found that it. Cockroach.
Yeah.
Here's the poison you need.
Yeah. Yep. That's
what it seems like.
Yeah. Also, if it is demonology, wouldn't this, you could kind of suspect that it might be an incubus?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. He should have been able to identify that.
Yeah.
Based on the moaning.
Come on.
So when the Warrens arrived at the scene, they all noticed two things that were not discussed in the phone call. The first thing was that Stacy's experimentation had gone beyond the Ouija board. While searching her room, they discovered Stacy and her friends had been collecting occult paperbacks that taught oaths and rituals. Allegedly, Stacy had been performing what she had learned from these books. The second thing was that Mrs. Collins admitted to seeing a shadow figure moving along the upstairs hallway one day. She described it as a black fog, and it floated into Stacy's room. Mrs. Collins admitted she didn't tell anyone out of fear people would think she was losing her mind.
That's like the Jackie Hernandez case, right?
Yeah, fair enough. This was all the Warrens needed to hear to believe that there was a demonic infestation at play. Ed called it a, quote, classic case of somebody experimenting with the occult and virtually, if not literally, inviting the demon into the household. Ed then told Mrs. Collins to let the psychiatric hospital know that they would be there soon. I'm sure the psychiatric hospital's like,
Oh, God.
Not again. Dr. Larson, the man overseeing Stacy's medical treatment, hesitated to invite them.
Yeah.
Because he's like, oh, God, this is going to make things way more complicated than they need to be. But according to Ed, he finally agreed because apparently the treatment that they were doing there just wasn't working. And so why not? Why not bring Ed and Lorraine over there? Mrs. Collins then phoned her husband at work, and Dr. Collins said that he would meet the Warrens, Father Martins, and his wife at the hospital in 2 hours.
I do have 2 points I want to at least bring up. I do like how quickly Ed's like, of demonic infestation, 100%. Like, they get this phone call, they go to the house, it's like immediately no questions asked. We haven't even met Stacy, and Ed Warren's already like, yes. This is the surefire signs. I know that this is a demonic infestation. Okay.
No investigation needed.
No.
Not a single paranormal tool from the toolbox comes out.
No.
It's just, you saw Black Fog. Oh, yeah. Oh, occult books. 1000% demon.
Yep. And a Ouija board. That's it. We got it all. And then my second point is, I wonder what the logistics are of getting paranormal investigators, demonologists into a psychiatric hospital. I wouldn't think that would be easy. And I would just assume it would cause a massive, like, dramatic social storm within the hospital.
Totally.
Like the Warrens are rolling in.
Yeah. None of that makes sense, does it? No, not at all. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, like, they're like, did they say who they were? Like, hi, I'm Ed Warren. I'm a demonologist. My wife is a clairvoyant and medium. We would like to come see Stacy and see if we can help the situation.
Yeah. Well, it sounded like they made Mrs. Collins called the hospital.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, I want to bring in these paranormal investigators and a demonologist and a medium.
Because they're telling me there's a demon in my house. Yeah. Like, and the doctor's like, well, I guess so. These tranquilizers aren't working on her, so maybe they'll be able to calm her down.
Yeah. If modern medicine can't do it,
something's not computing here.
Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm asking too many questions. Maybe I should just accept it.
Accept this as real.
Yeah.
Reality.
Why would the Warrens lie to me?
They have nothing to gain from this whatsoever.
Not a book
deal. They're just trying to help.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
They want to help Stacy get better.
They only have good Catholic intentions in their hearts.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Don't forget that.
So with their good Catholic intentions, they headed over to the hospital. It was a dreary day in New Hampshire.
Because of course.
Yeah.
It wasn't a bright sunny. No,
that wouldn't make sense for this.
No.
So rain fell on the old psychiatric hospital built of dark red brick. The rusted iron gates surrounded the property, and when the Warrens arrived at the security entrance, an armed guard in a rain poncho asked, "State your business," before letting them through. Once they got inside, nurses and doctors rushed from room to room. It was very busy. So the Warrens then greeted Dr. Larson on the third floor, and he led them into Stacy's room, which was just a cramped little space with a single twin bed in the center. They found Dr. Collins sitting on the edge of the bed, and Stacy was lying down in her blue pajamas, completely ignoring her father. They noticed, just as before, her eyes were extremely dull and distracted, and she barely even recognized the group when they entered the room. Dr. Collins quietly greeted everyone and allowed the Warrens and Father Martins to begin their process. Father Martins approached Stacy as she lay in bed, and in a low voice, he reassured her that everything would be fine, but she didn't even respond to him. Physically, her body, she was there in the room, but Stacy, as her parents once knew her, it seemed like she was just not there. It's just something else in her body, essentially. Father Martins then pulled a small crucifix from his pocket in his black garb and moved it toward her, but before he could even get close, Stacy immediately began screaming. She jerked her body away from the crucifix and began cursing him with a variety of swear words, taunts, and blasphemies. We got a classic exorcist.
Fuck you, motherfucker.
Yeah. The Collins begged their daughter, please behave, but it was no use. The Warrens calmed both of them down and explained that this was all just a part of the process. They had seen it many times before. So they watched in horror as Stacy just squirmed in her bed while Father Martins kind of held out his crucifix toward her. Her eyes then turned from a dull blue to a deep amber color, and spittle formed at the corners of her mouth while she screamed blasphemies. Father Martin then began to speak over her directly to the demon that had infested her body. He said, "You will be banished." She then reached up and tried to claw the crucifix from his hand. By now, it was a whole scene. Mrs. Collins was wailing and sobbing, so Dr. Collins led her from the room. The Warrens and Father Martins then circled the hospital bed. They were finally alone with... I imagine this is like, they're like, the parents are gone now. Now the real business begins. And like, kind of the lights go down.
I hope that Dr. Larson was at least in there to make sure that...
Just sitting in the corner, like, what's going on?
So virtually an exorcism is taking place at this point, or the beginning of one.
Kind of the preliminary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just see if we can piss this thing off.
Yeah, exactly. They're Crucifix. Just provoking it. Yeah. So Lorraine spoke, "We're here to help you, and we can help you." They listened as an odd, threatening, gurgling response came from inside Stacy's chest. And Father Martins immediately withdrew his crucifix. He had seen something like this before, a demonic presence physically manifesting inside someone.
Just like that.
Exactly like that. And he didn't want to push it anymore, because you know what? It seemed like it was threatening enough. So they all abandoned the room, and before leaving, this is super cheesy, Ed turned. And he told the demon, "We'll be back."
Fuck you. Fuck
you. Nice. Very exorcist style. That's good.
Seems like that's literally where the story's going. It's the exorcist plot here.
Yep. So out in the hall, Father Martins told them Stacy needed a proper exorcism. This wasn't something a simple blessing could cure. He needed permission from the Catholic Church, but that would usually take some time. He also requested that another priest join him. Within 18 hours, which this is wild, the turnaround time on this, the church provided Father Martins with another priest and the permission to go forward with the exorcism.
Mainline to the Vatican, it seems like.
We got it. I think you have to get, a bishop's approval?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It's like which a bishop kind of runs a whole region.
Seems like they should have called Father Mort. Get him in here. Get the big guns in here.
Speaking of 10,000 cases, that was like the same number, 10,000 exorcisms or something like that? 15,000?
Yeah, it was more than that. It was more than 10,000. I think he said like 50,000 or something.
That's crazy. Yeah. Multiple exorcisms a day.
That's right.
So before returning to Stacy's room, Father Martins performed extended prayer and meditation sessions throughout the day. He also performed a black fast, which is a strict form of fasting where he did not consume food or water while the sun was up. After sunset, he only ate bread and drank only water between his sessions of prayer, sleep, and he also went on these little walks. They were like meditative walks. Lorraine was worried that this would take too much out of him and that he wouldn't be prepared for the demonic exorcism. As Lorraine put it, exorcisms are, quote, one of the most physically demanding rites in the church. She's basically like, hey, you need a big boy breakfast before we get in here.
You need to hit the Denny's.
Yeah.
Get that Grand Slam breakfast before we...
Where's the hot dog hutch at?
That's right. Get a couple glizzies. Some protein, man.
Yeah. So on the day of the exorcism, Father Martins put on his purple stole and openly prayed to God to release Stacy from the demonic grasp. As they approached her room, Dr. Larson paced the hallway. He was actually worried if he was making the right choice by just letting these people in here to perform an exorcism.
He's got to be worried about his job.
I know, like, and your reputation.
Seriously,
right?
Like, what are the other doctors? Like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah, man? Dr. Larson, he's a bit sketch. But his spiritual side figured, you know what? Maybe this is Stacy's only option.
And I think we got to think about the time period.
True.
It was 70s, different.
Yeah.
It was a little different, right?
That's fair.
Like, nowadays, yeah. This probably would never happen.
Right. And it'd probably be all over the news if this was going on, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like this TMZ. Hospital's letting it.
Yeah. TMZ would be there.
Yeah. How are they always there?
They're always there, dude. They always
They're
have
really
the
quick
video.
On that.
Yeah. A little too quick sometimes.
A little too suspiciously quick.
Yeah.
Huh. We're on to you, TMZ. When the next morning finally arrived, it was another overcast and rainy day outside.
Because the devil's in town.
Father Martins and his aide made their way through the hospital and into Stacy's room. The Warrens followed close behind, and Lorraine could see the effects of the black fast on Father Martins. Apparently his hands were shaking, his eyes were glassy from the lack of sleep, and his voice was raspier than usual.
And this is supposed to prepare him for an exorcism? How does that make any sense whatsoever?
So I think
he's filled with spiritual energy.
It's the fasting is supposed to...
The physical energy is gone.
Yes.
But spiritually, he's at all-time high.
The fast is to give him spiritual strength.
Okay.
Not physical strength.
All right. Well, here's what happens next. They settled into Stacy's room and hovered over her bed, and then began the process reciting prayers and blessings. Father Martins demanded that Satan, in the name of Christ, the Blessed Virgin, and all the saints, leave Stacy and the Collins family home immediately. Throughout the exorcism, Stacy violently reacted to Father Martin's words and emotions, lashing out and nearly striking him at times. Other times, Father Martin's exorcism sent shockwaves through Stacy's body. Lorraine described her as, quote, being shot with invisible bullets. She writhed in the bed. Sometimes her screams sounded like sexual ecstasy. Sometimes her screams were pure pain. It's coming from Lorraine.
Yep.
So she's just there for the ride, I guess. It's going to be okay, sweetie.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. Like, why isn't Lorraine, like, trying to talk to this demon and, like, reason with it?
Are they just letting the priest do their thing? They don't want to get in the way?
I assume so. So, like, what value did they provide here? Anyways, that's a different conversation.
But I do like her description, being shot with invisible bullets. That does really, yeah.
So dramatic. Yeah. God, it's horrible.
And there's the sexual component again, kind of rears its head. She's going from sexual ecstasy to pain.
It's interesting that Ed doesn't ever mention the word incubus.
Yeah.
He didn't really like work very hard to identify, you know, like, or get a name, or because in other cases he has done that.
He's attempted pretty specific.
To speak with the demon and identify it.
Yeah.
But we don't have that info here.
No, it's just a demon.
They're just like, all right, bring the priest in, let him do his work.
Nope.
And that's what he did. Father Martins continued without stopping, and he even began speaking directly to the demon, and the demon would respond in a guttural voice. Loud thumping sounds came from the wall beside them, like something was pounding from within the wall, trying to escape. Soon a rancid odor filled the room, and it grew so overwhelming that they all had to cover their mouths and noses. Everyone except for Stacy. Stacy then began throwing any object nearby she could get her hands on while screaming curses. According to Lorraine, other times she would swear, but in a way where she splayed her body across the bed, like she was taking some kind of sexual pleasure.
There it is again.
Yeah, it's very disturbing to think about. Luckily, over time, the energy of the demon lessened more and more until it faded completely. Stacy was finally silent and not moving on the bed. Lorraine said that there was always a fear that at the end of an exorcism, the afflicted person might be dead from pure exhaustion and strain. But Stacy was still very much alive. It had taken nearly an hour to complete the rite of exorcism, and by the end, Father Martins had spent so much energy, he began to collapse. The exorcism had taken almost everything out of him, and he had to be supported by Ed and his aide. When he finally regained his composure, the priests gathered their things and entered the hall. As standard procedure for Father Martins, they needed to wait to see if the exorcism had in fact worked. In about another half hour, Stacy seemed to be cured. The Collins went in to see their daughter, and Stacy laid on the bed and opened her eyes to look at them. Dr. Collins said, quote, "It was the first real hope I'd known in months." Her eyes were back to normal, and there was even a small smile on her face. As she spoke, Stacy's voice also returned to the sweet, pleasant voice she once had. 4 days later, she was allowed to return home. She even cleaned up her room and offered to help with dinner. Wow.
Back to a perfect
child. That's a complete transformation.
Yeah, it's the golden child they once knew.
Yeah. So they're like, wow, we got our daughter back. She's finally the old Stacy that they had known and loved. As for Father Martins, he experienced a withdrawal period after the exorcism and needed some much needed rest. In those following days, Lorraine would often bring him some ice cream, his favorite treat.
Cute.
And his face would light up. Yes, soft serve. Everybody loves soft serve.
Especially hospital soft serve.
Yeah, dude. And after about 5 days of rest, he finally regained his strength and he left to return home. About 3 weeks passed and everything seemed to go back to normal. But unfortunately, the demon emerged again. Ed thought the demon had been lying dormant inside Stacy and was never fully exorcised. Once it had regained its strength, it returned in full force. The Collins then brought Stacy back to the hospital, and some of the hospital staff debated if the exorcism helped or not, which I would fucking hope so, that they had a conversation about this. What?
I mean, I'd be like,
we allowed that?
Yeah, I'd be like, okay, if she's back, come on. Also, I wouldn't trust Dr. Larson anymore.
No.
Like, come on, man.
I would hope whoever's his boss did something about this.
Yeah, for like, sure.
That's kind of scary. As time passed, Stacy seemed to get better with treatment and medication, but throughout her life, she was still afflicted by what the doctor called, quote, attacks. And Dr. Larson, seeing that the exorcism wasn't successful, believed Stacy's affliction was entirely caused by her failing mental health.
So he's even admitting that now?
Bro.
Ugh.
And guess what? The Warrens disagreed. They said, no, the demon is back. And that this is a spiritual problem. But unfortunately, we're all out of solutions here. There's nothing more that we can do. Father Martins eventually returned to his home country of Nigeria not long after the exorcism. And at the time, Nigeria was plagued by political violence during a civil war. And according to Lorraine, revolutionaries at the time hated Catholics and had begun executing priests and nuns. After his arrival home, several other church members had seen Father Martins for a time, but then he disappeared completely. Wow. As for the Ouija board that Stacy had found in the antique attic store, no one knows what happened to it. Some think it was confiscated by hospital staff and later destroyed, which I fucking hope they did that. If it was ever there in the first place.
Right.
But some believe other hospital patients stole it.
Could be. It's just one Ouija board. They're cycling through all the hospital patients there.
Others believe Stacy might have gotten her hands on it again and hit it like she had before, but its fate is still a mystery to this day. And that's where the story ends.
That's it.
Stacy's, hopefully she made it out all right.
Yeah.
I hope she got better with time.
She would be quite old today. I tried to find any updates on her or anything, but I could not find anything.
So this was actually an L for the Warrens.
Big L. And they seem to give up pretty quickly. They're like, yep, we try
like,
it.
Well, sorry. She can't do it. No one can.
Yeah.
Guess she's going to be dealing with that demon forever.
And I bet maybe there's some unwritten parts of this story where it's like, the Warrens are not allowed to back to this psychiatric hospital. I wonder if that was maybe going on.
It's interesting. This one was never made into a movie.
Yeah. Which shows that something was failing, right?
Yeah.
And then I couldn't verify what hospital it was, and maybe it's because, you know,
they were banned.
They
were put on the do not come back. They got trespassed.
Yeah, exactly. And that armed guard at the gate now knows them.
Yeah.
He's like, you're not coming back in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty wild story. Danny, any comments on that exorcism?
I know you fully believe.
He believes
this story.
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful and well-written story. I think it's a wonderful piece of fiction. There's no proof. There's no proof. There's nothing. It's not even a name, not a state, not a city.
That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
But trust me, bro, coming from the supposedly the most well-known and renowned paranormal investigators of all time, I need a scrap of evidence, like a name. Just give me a name. Stacy's not enough. Give me a surname.
Well, we got Stacy Collins. We got her last name, but I couldn't verify that she even existed.
Is that because it's a
pseudonym?
Yeah,
there are stories where they want to protect themselves so they don't give specific details. So it could be that going on.
Or are they trying to protect those involved?
Right.
From being hounded and, you know, people like coming up and asking them like, hey, heard the Warrens investigated you.
Right.
What happened?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe they're doing it out of a place of like, we're trying to protect the people that we work with. So we don't release all the details.
That could be true.
Which I think is probably like an angle that they've used before.
They probably had several cases out of the thousands that they did where the family was probably like, we don't really want this story out there. If you use it, don't use our real names.
And because this happened in a hospital too, right? Like, so right. There's the, you know,
HIPAA
privacy there.
Right.
So maybe there's a reason why that never came out. And the dad's a doctor.
Right.
So he would have known how to, you know, make sure that the real names and places don't ever get out there.
Yeah.
But it's okay to make a book on this, you know.
Right. Yeah.
We're good
yeah.
with that. Just don't put the
details. No real details. Yeah. It also makes the parents look a little bad too. They took so long.
A little bad?
It makes them look like bad parents for sure.
Totally.
It makes the doctor from the hospital look really bad. So I could see how maybe some people just wanted to protect their identities in this one.
Maybe I'm biased due to the next part of the episode. Then we can circle back to
that.
It weakened my trust in the Warrens completely. My already very thin trust.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where we put the final nails in the coffin here.
Yeah. So for any big Warren stands out there, apologies beforehand, but we feel like we got to get into this, you know?
I think we have a responsibility to at least mention what we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
Especially since we've, you know, covered so many of their stories. And again, you know, we've covered the stories because, like, from a purely paranormal story perspective, these are some of the most compelling, entertaining. Yeah. And there's a reason why they've registered with so many people across the world, and why they've done so well as films. And I think there's something just inherently intriguing about it. And here's this couple, you know,
yeah, that, interesting, you know, dynamic, kind of
this power couple that's like conquering the paranormal together with their special skill sets. And, you know, I think that's why we're all drawn into it, right?
Yeah, it's a good.
And the movies really amplify that. And like, we all fall in love, like, I love the actors that play Ed and Lorraine in the movies.
Yeah,
and, I think it, you know, from that perspective, it's very entertaining. And, you know, I totally become a fan of that.
Yeah. And I think that was, you know, pretty strategic that we all do love the Warrens in a fictionalized film.
Right.
But that often doesn't track to reality, right?
You could say that about a lot of different,
yeah,
you know, actors and people out there.
For sure.
People have some sort of fame, right?
Yeah. But it is very obvious, you know, that the Warrens on screen didn't really track in real life. And we'll dig into it a little bit here. We're not really going to cover the hoaxes. If anyone thinks we're alluding to that, we're going to talk about something else. So whatever your opinions on their paranormal careers might be, it's safe to say that these gentle, empathetic Warrens we see in the Conjuring universe are not really true to life. Because allegedly, in the early 1960s, when Ed Warren was in his 30s working as a city bus driver, he initiated a relationship with 15-year-old Judith Penny. Lorraine knew the whole time. Top studio executives of the first Conjuring film were made aware of the allegations just weeks after the Conjuring film opened in 2013. So in 2017, The Hollywood Reporter ran a big story about this alleged affair that Ed Warren had with a minor at the time, Judith Penny. The following is mostly from that article, along with a Vox article that ran on Halloween Day last year. If you want to read into it yourself, you're more than welcome to. We'll post the
sources. Yeah, we're going to kind of summarize the article a little bit and, you know, pull the key takeaways.
Yeah. So Judith Penny, who was in her 70s at the time of her sworn declaration, said that she lived in the Warren's house as Ed's lover for 4 decades. An attorney for the movie studio claimed in court papers that a disgruntled author and a producer were suing the studio over profits from the franchise. And they were possibly pushing this story of the Warrens' personal lives as a part of a vendetta. So keep that in mind. The Sparas, who this is the Warrens' daughter and son-in-law, claimed they never witnessed any misconduct and believed that Judith was manipulated into making these accusations. So the following are the allegations made by Judith Penny. So keep that in mind. These are allegations. We're not speaking on this as its truth. But this is her truth and this is her story. So at first, Judith stayed in their Bridgeport house in a bedroom directly across from the Warrens' bedroom. Eventually, she moved into a separate apartment built for her above the home. Ed would then alternate between sleeping in the bedrooms, and Lorraine was fully complicit. Their relationship was reported to the police in 1963, and Judith was arrested for, quote, delinquency. She spent a night at the North End prison in Bridgeport while police tried to persuade her to sign a statement admitting to the affair. Judith apparently refused, but she was ordered by the court to report to a delinquent youth office for the next month. Ed was never investigated. Ed then continued to pick her up from school every week and drove her to the mandated meetings that she had, the delinquent youth office meetings. Ed told her many times that she was the, quote, love of his life, but Judith was often described as Ed's assistant or liaison as a way to keep their relationship hidden. Her presence in the Bridgeport house even got a nod in a 1980 book about the Warrens, The Demonologist. The affair would allegedly continue until just a few years before Ed's death in 2006. And in 2017, Judith said, quote, as I'm older now, I can't even fathom why Lorraine let me stay there. Lots of times I think about it. Why did I do this? Why did I screw up my life like this? Sometimes I get angry thinking about it, how so much was taken away from me.
Yeah, just, I mean, very, very disturbing to say the least, that this happened and went on as long as it did. And I'm so confused as to how the police never investigated Ed. You know, what was the situation there? Was it just the police felt like they didn't have enough proof? Or I think what happened was they were like, she's a delinquent youth. We can't trust anything that she says, and we're going to believe, even though this scenario is completely weird.
Yeah. And we'll find, like, she was from a broken home, and they kind of took her in as their own child, so to speak. They were her guardians. So there's some layers of complexity there.
But then it gets worse.
Yeah.
In May 1978, in her 30s, Judith allegedly became pregnant with Ed's child. According to Judith, Lorraine then persuaded her to have an abortion because the birth of a child could become a scandal and could ruin the Warrens' business. Judith claimed that Lorraine's, quote, real God is money. Then they tried to get Judith to say that she was raped. She didn't, but she ultimately did go ahead with an abortion. Judith also claimed that Ed was abusive toward Lorraine, and one time she witnessed Ed allegedly backhand Lorraine so hard she lost consciousness. She said, quote, some nights I thought they were going to kill each other. I was just like, wow. Lorraine's attorney, Gary Barkin, says the family has no knowledge of the alleged conduct, and Lorraine, who was 90 at the time of the accusations, was in declining health and unable to respond to these allegations. Lorraine's attorney also claimed that they had taken Judith in when she was 18 because she came from a broken home and was neglected as a child. While the Warrens went to investigate paranormal cases, Judith would stay at their home and watch the house. They also said that when she lived with them, Judith had a long-term boyfriend for much of the time, whom she eventually married, and the couple spent holidays with their family. It appears that Judith has... Did you want to say something?
Yeah, just one thing that I'm noticing now after going through this story again. It is odd they specify she was 18.
Yeah.
Why would you take in an adult, a legal adult? I mean, I can see it maybe if she really needed a guardian, but you're a legal adult at 18. So,
well, maybe it was more of like a job type of thing. Like, that's the thing I'm curious about is... I'm sure there's records, like, was she an employee? Did they pay her to be like kind of their assistant?
And watch their house when they were gone. Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
So it seems like...
But they specify, it's like, we brought her in because she was from a broken home and neglected as a child. So I'm just a little confused on that, but...
Because the age is very important in this.
Right.
It's
right.
The most important factor here. To these allegations. So which is it?
Right.
Was she 15 or was she 18?
Right.
And I think that's the part we don't know for sure, just because there hasn't been, you know, much like public evidence around this,
right.
Like release. You know, this has been very like hush hush and has come out through very weird ways, it seems like, you know. So it appears that Judith hadn't made any money from the Conjuring movie universe. And as for her relationship with Ed, according to the Hollywood Reporter article, she still seems to have fond feelings for him, but she clearly had no love for Lorraine by the end. Judith and Ed's relationship allegedly ended in 2003. She then married and remained friendly with Ed until his death in 2006. Even still, Lorraine's deal with New Line Cinema, who produced The Conjuring, had some strange restrictions. And this is kind of the part that I think we're all like, okay, if this, you know, if these allegations aren't true, why would this be included?
Yeah, and this is on paper.
This is on paper. We do know for sure. So these were some of the contract stipulations that Lorraine had added to her deal with New Line Cinema, and this is what they include. The films couldn't show her or her husband engaging in crimes, including sex with minors, child pornography, prostitution, or sexual assault, and neither the husband nor wife in the movies could be depicted as participating in an extramarital sexual relationship, which is like, whoa.
Yeah, why is this
so specific?
Yeah.
And like, why on earth would any of these things ever even be a part of a Conjuring movie?
Right, especially considering that these are our protagonists in these movies. Why would they want to throw in that Ed is like a pedophile? Like, what? They wouldn't even want to do that,
yeah,
in my opinion. It doesn't even make sense. Very specific.
It's very specific. And I think that's what's so sus about all this is, yeah, like, why? If none of that is true, then why are you worried about it?
Yeah. And is it just like, maybe they're to give them the benefit of the doubt? Yeah. Is it just like, hey, we want to protect our image, and this is just kind of a blanket legal statement? I don't know.
Or she knew that this was eventually going to, you know, make it out there publicly. And this was kind of her just like, well, these allegations are, you know, false, and I just want to get ahead of it, and I want to make sure that it doesn't somehow get spun into the, because I think I can understand being overly cautious when working with like a big company like that, New Line Cinema. Sure. And when you are being personally represented, like the warrant, their name is out there. I could understand why you would want to go to great lengths to protect yourself from a company like that, to skewing your image or making you out to be something that you're not. I just think this specificity of this is so odd.
Agreed.
And is it possible there's other language that she asked for that just didn't make it into this article because it doesn't, you know, it's not as like shocking as this is? I don't know. Like, is there more to it? Like, it'd be interesting to review the whole contract, right? And see all the language and all the requests. Because I would imagine there were probably other things she'd asked for in addition to this as well. So is it like, the reporter trying, like the Hollywood Reporter's pulling this because it fits into the story and the narrative that's being told, and they're leaving out, well, she also asked for, you know, other things that could potentially make her husband look bad.
Yeah.
That maybe anybody else who's having a film inspired by their own personal life's events would put in there.
Yeah.
And that's the hard thing. Not saying that this is not weird. This is fucking so weird.
Super weird. It's also hard to find the smoking gun, because it was this Lorraine requesting these, mm-hmm, or was this what, like, their lawyer was like, hey, we're gonna whip up this blanket,
right,
statement and be very careful about it. So we don't even really know if Lorraine had requested these restrictions in,
right,
the first place, right?
Because talent attorney Jill Smith argued that many legal deals prevent depictions of certain types of behavior that are, quote, not relevant to the underlying story, in which typically the person is not known to have participated.
So
based on that statement, it is possible that, I mean, it's Hollywood, dude.
Right, right.
Like, none of us have done a deal in Hollywood, so none of us know. And I'm sure there's probably actors and people out there, like, because I know I've heard actors talk about like sex scenes,
mm-hmm,
and how all of those have to be like worked into their contract. Or I can imagine even like in like the Terrifier movies, like what's in their contracts, like that they're, right, agreeing to, and how they're being portrayed and things that are happening to them. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm, in any type of horror film, I'm sure there's maybe some odd sounding language in there just based on the nature of the genre.
Right.
You would think, right?
Yeah.
But it is weird based on, you know, all of the allegations that this is in there. You know, so I get.
But man, it is like in this contract, were there, was there verbiage where they couldn't depict them producing a hoax or committing fraud? Right. Like, where are those crimes listed in this? Were they? I don't know, because this was the snippet that was pulled from the contract. So, like, we keep circling back to, it's the specificity that makes it worrisome, and that they wouldn't be specific about other things to protect their careers. I don't know.
Because there's also one of the producers who is suing, because there was a whole bunch of legal drama around the Conjuring films and who had the rights to it, the copyrights and all that. And there was a producer that was like, clearly had a, like, it seemed like he clearly had a vendetta against them, and was like outright calling Ed a pedophile, and like was going very, very hard to try to, you know, I guess, influence the litigation and,
yeah,
you know, try to like insert himself into the deal. And so it got very, very nasty.
And that's, they were trying to, you know, you could say they were trying to sow some doubt in
right
to what was happening, which is why the circumstance and the timing of Judith's allegations coming out were made it a little more suspect. Not to say that she's lying, but it's like, oh, why did this come out when it did just after the first Conjuring movie?
Right. I think it's all things to consider.
Yeah.
You know, and again, we're not saying that Judith's allegations are not, you know, not true.
Right.
Cause yeah, I mean, it's her truth. If that's what happened, and you know, who are we to tell,
exactly,
tell her that it didn't. So
exactly.
But as a small side note, aside from the sexual allegations, Judith also said she helped Ed videotape the white lady. If you remember her from,
I do.
One of our previous episodes,
that was
the
a while
Union
back.
Cemetery. Yeah. So we, you know, we talked quite a bit about the white lady, the ghost who haunts that cemetery in Easton, Connecticut. And Ed claimed he caught the ghost on tape in the summer of 1990 after camping out in the graveyard for a week. But Judith claimed Ed wanted to make a video showing what the white lady would look like if she were spotted, so she wore a white sheet for the filming. So again, is he hoaxing here? Seems like it, but is it also just thinking ahead of, like,
yeah, doing some test videos or something? Who knows?
But I think it does speak to the idea that these guys are like con artists, they're hoaxers, they're,
yeah,
you know, they definitely were trying to make something out of nothing, it seems like, quite a bit. So definitely something to keep in mind. But either way, Judith's allegations have left a permanent stain on the Warrens' legacy, and they have also become a strong reminder that the couple's image on camera is not a true representative of who they were in real life.
Right.
And I think that's an important distinction to make, and clearly something New Line Cinema, you know, has made, is that this is like, it's inspired by, we're not
right
doing a, you know, fact for fact, and like this
right
is a direct representative of them.
Right.
It's Hollywood, right?
It's Hollywood.
So I understand why, you know, people feel the way that they do about the Warrens. I think there's so many things that are very suspect, especially as you heard in this episode. This one was very suspect for me. It was
for
like,
sure. There have also been documentaries like poking holes in
totally
some of their other ones. And I know, you know, I know that even their first like major one, the Amityville Horror, has a lot of people have poked a ton of holes in it. Even that one. But yeah, it's hard because it's like, you know, they produce a lot of really great paranormal stories to tell. I think that's at the heart of it, right? And that's why people love the Warrens, not the real Warrens, but just the Warren Files, this kind of legacy of putting the paranormal to paper and getting it on film,
yeah,
kind of making it a bit more mainstream where at one point it wasn't. And I think that's basically why we are attracted to these stories. So I'm okay with just believing that they were total hoaxers and frauds and sexual predators, that's whatever, because I can kind of separate in my mind that the movies that I'm watching are, that's not Ed Warren, that's not Lorraine Warren, right?
Well, couldn't you argue too, like every single paranormal story ever told is a hoax? You know what I mean? Like,
what do you
what is that what you do?
Because like, I mean, let's be real. It's like, there's so many stories where there's just the paranormal is exactly what it is. It's like, we're not able to capture this like groundbreaking evidence. And
it's hard to explain.
You can pick apart almost every piece of evidence brought forth during a paranormal investigation in some way, shape or form.
Right.
And that's what makes it the paranormal, is there's a little bit of faith. There's a little bit of belief that goes into it in order to make it entertaining for yourself and to enjoy its ghost stories at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah.
It hasn't really changed after all these years. And obviously like we're starting to develop, you know, scientific techniques to investigate the paranormal, which I think is awesome to start. Let's apply science to this and try to find ways to detect these anomalies and the unexplained. And I think it's good that we're kind of breaking away from the religious dogma a little bit and trying to look at it without sort of that biased approach.
Yeah, like the Catholic lens.
Yeah,
of and demons like, and exorcisms.
Exactly, yeah. And associating everything spooky that happens with a demonic infestation or some type of ghost, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that maybe there's things that we just don't know yet, and we haven't yet figured out what is the cause or the source.
Right. Yeah, and that was always one of my biggest gripes, is like, how do we have a rule set for these things? Things that are paranormal and we cannot explain. How are people whipping up exact, like categorizing these things and naming these things? And I don't know, it seems a bit, it makes me feel like it's a bit bogus when you can narrow it down so specifically.
With so much confidence.
Yeah.
Right. And then you do the things that you're supposed to do for it and it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like, true.
Right.
Yeah, like this. Yeah.
You know, like they thought with 1000% certainty that this was a demonic infestation. They have their protocols for how to deal with that. They bring in, you know, they bring in this priest who's apparently a gladiator and, you know,
yeah.
When it comes to demons, and he's not even able to do it. And then, you know, you find out after the fact, like she's been dealing with serious mental health issues. And
right.
I think that was likely the cause the entire time. And then you infuse it with religion and then things can go all sorts of different directions. And I'm glad that as time has gone on and we've progressed and evolved that, you know, even, you know, people who are religious are, you know, much more open to, you know, not just like latching on to
the Ouija board.
Right. It's the Ouija board. It's based on my beliefs. It has to be this, you know, and like science is becoming very interconnected with religion and things are evolving. It's not quite as old fashioned, I guess, as it used to be when it comes to that, which I think is great for all of us in society. And I think, again, I think time period really plays to the Warren's advantage throughout their cases, because it's very much, you know, religion was still very much a kind of a controlling factor for a lot of people. And people were very influenced by their spiritual leaders and stuff. And I think as time has gone on and as, you know, more and more spiritual leaders get exposed for, you know, the heinous humans they really are, you know, not all, but some people have put less and less faith in those so-called leaders and, you know, are thinking more critically for themselves. And, you know, maybe you still believe in God, but you also believe in science and medicine and doctors and the understanding of the brain and like understanding. Cause again, like if you think back to this time period, there's all these mental illnesses that hadn't even been discovered yet. Right. And we didn't understand. And now with technology and science, we're able to pinpoint exactly where the issue is. And in some cases, and then we've also developed medications that are able to balance out the different, you know, issues with the brain. And we're able to track all of that so much more than before. Cause back then it was like, well, we tried these three things that we know of and none of them work. So guess it must be a demon.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and then it's like psychiatric hospitals used to be just put them in the cage.
Yeah.
Lock it and throw away the key.
Sedate them. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way from from them. But it also, I get it, as far as the Warrens go, it's like, if you're dealing with unexplained things that are supernatural, of course you would look at it through the lens of your faith, right? It just kind of naturally seems to make sense.
It's what they know.
Yeah.
They didn't really evolve beyond their faith.
Right.
And I think that's where, you know, a lot of paranormal enthusiasts and investigators would be like, yeah, that's where they failed, is they were one track minded and they didn't ever consider other possibilities here throughout all of these cases they researched and investigated. So I think they kind of carried the torch as far as they possibly could when it comes to the paranormal. And I think, you know, I don't know if any of us will ever really, really know, unless like the family came out and like made a statement, was like, yeah, all of it was fake.
That would be crazy.
We have no evidence. There is nothing. Yeah. It was all just a hoaxed operation.
What are the Spares up to these days?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Tony
still got the channel, right?
Their son-in-law has the YouTube channel. And then I don't even know if the Warren's daughter has ever even really been public at all.
No.
From what I've seen, but I know they still have the house, the Warren's house.
And the objects and
Bridgeport,
stuff.
Bridgeport, I think, and the Haunted Museum, but I don't even think that's open to the public now. It seems like they keep a very low profile.
It also seems like a very hard legacy to carry.
Totally. On. Well, where do you take it from here?
Right.
Especially now, you know, you have these allegations out there, and, you know, maybe it's just best that it just ends. You know, this is the end of it. And it seems like, you know, The Conjuring, The Last Rites film.
You think it's going to be the last one?
I kind of feel like they might be wrapping it up, but
it is. It's getting to feel like a played out universe at this point.
It's kind of overstayed their welcome at this point, you know?
So I wouldn't be sad to see it go.
I wouldn't be sad to see her go.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to put her away for good.
We just light her on fire.
Yeah.
She hasn't been here for a while.
I mean, there's there's something so, you know, fun about this.
Exactly.
I guess.
I mean, that's, in a sick maybe not. Way. Yeah.
But that, you know, we're all fans of this Conjuring universe that Hollywood created. But we're not fans of, you know, what the Warrens actually did and what they stand for at this point. So just important to know. But obviously we want to know what your thoughts are, because, you know, I think people are kind of all over the place with this. And
I feel like our fans have been kind of quiet. So I would like to hear where people are at on this.
Yeah. And maybe there's something we're missing, or, you know, we looked far and wide to see if there was any updates or any sort of, I don't see anything since this.
No, Vox covered it last year, but it was essentially just reiterating the same story again.
So, yeah, I think this is the end of the Warrens here. Lights out.
We're putting them to rest.
Putting them to rest. I think it was a long journey. I mean, a couple years.
Yeah.
On this journey.
I think the first one was like, what, episode two? Yeah.
It was, the Arnie Johnson, Devil Made Me Do It.
Yeah.
And, you know, some great stories, some crazy paranormal activity. But I think that's going to be the end for us. And moving on, who's our next?
There, I know there are a few out there, some big names still out there.
Yeah. I think.
In San Pedro haunting, Jackie's case, I think that proved there are still very convincing stories out there.
Yeah. Yeah. With that being said, we have a very fun Halloween episode.
Yes.
For you guys this year. I think you guys will really enjoy it. So we'll see you guys next week. Till then, lights out, everybody.